This is the IBJ podcast for the week of August 2nd, 2021, brought to you by Resultant, formerly KSM Consulting. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, in this week for Mason King. It was several years ago when Indy Chambers' Michael Huber and other leaders first came to IBJ to share some startling statistics about what was essentially a bifurcation of Indianapolis. The wealthier parts of the community were continuing to improve their economic situation, but they were not carrying poverty-stricken areas of the city along with them. In fact, the gap between the haves and have-nots was increasing, and Indy Chamber leaders had concluded that could not continue if Indianapolis was to prosper. As a result, the Chamber launched a number of initiatives aimed at inclusive growth, including a rewriting of the rules that govern which companies receive incentives for investing in or adding jobs in Indianapolis. It was able to make that change in cooperation with Mayor Joe Hogsett's administration because Indy Chamber actually serves as the city's economic development arm. In 2020, the city, through the Incentive Initiative, provided more than $14 million in incentives to companies that pledged to pay wages of roughly $18 an hour or more and offer health care, child care, or transportation benefits. The Chamber said that created 4,125 new jobs and retained 4,827 jobs. The program was one of two that earned Indy Chamber the 2021 Chamber of the Year Award, presented by the Association of Chamber of Commerce Executives. Indy Chamber was chosen from among 1,600 chambers and related economic groups that are part of the organization. I invited Michael Huber and Vincent Ash, the Chamber's Director of Economic Development, to talk about the Incentive Initiative, as well as the work Indy Chamber has done to provide grants, loans, and information to not only its members, but all Indianapolis businesses throughout the pandemic. That Rapid Response Hub was the second program cited by the Chamber Association in choosing Indianapolis as the Chamber of the Year. Here's our conversation. Michael and Vincent, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Leslie.
Appreciate being here.
So congratulations on the honor that you all received. And we'll get into the details about the programs that led to the honor. But I think what I found the most interesting is that you guys won this award for projects that are really not what you would consider a typical Chamber of Commerce type of project. So all these things we're going to talk about, how do they reflect the direction Indy Chamber is heading in?
Yeah, Leslie, I think there are some good things that Chambers of Commerce have stood for generations, and Indy Chamber is no different. 130 some years old, founded by people like Colonel Eli Lilly. And yet, as we look at it in 2021, we want to represent business in its full diversity. Certainly the country's becoming more diverse. Our Indianapolis community is becoming more diverse. And I know we're going to get into it, but the moves that we've made have really represented us stretching out, branching out, doing a lot more in the small business entrepreneurial sector and making sure that we're adding value within Indianapolis, that you don't have to be a member. And I'm going to ask Vincent to elaborate on this because, Vincent, I mean, the nature of the Indianapolis business community is changing. And I feel like if we went on autopilot, we'd be leaving out more and more and more, especially small businesses.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think what, you know, COVID in the last year during the pandemic has kind of exposes there are a lot of disparities between entrepreneurs and business owners, access to capital kind of being one of that. And we kind of learned firsthand with our loans and grant process that we were able to do and administer on behalf of the city of Indianapolis last year and a few other partners, that those disparities were exact as exacerbated because of the pandemic.
This kind of work has to really be done intentionally. So how did you come to the point where you knew you had to make some changes and go in some new directions?
Definitely a catalyzing factor happened in 2017, 2018. Through our participation in a program with the Brookings Institution with our counterparts in Nashville, Tennessee, and San Diego, California. That project was called Inclusive Economic Growth Learning Lab. And the IBJ has reported on it and other trends that Vincent referred to in the One City Worlds Apart series. But after going through this process, particularly with Brookings and sharing it throughout the community, it became pretty obvious that, again, if our Chamber of Commerce organization went forward without making changes, we would be representing a lot of sectors of the economy that really cater to people with traditional four-year degrees or advanced degrees. And those are really important sectors, but we would be missing out on doing everything we can to grow the kind of jobs that are going to benefit high poverty neighborhoods, that are going to create the opportunities for people to get into, you know, four-year degrees or associate's degree jobs, things like that. But the scary thing was, and I'll say scary, was we realized we were missing out on supporting a high percentage of the Indianapolis region. And Vincent, I know you went through that as a, you know, an economic development practitioner. What was your experience?
Yeah, I would even say it probably even predates that, you know, as a chamber, 7 years ago when the chamber decided to merge with and put a priority on economic development and merge with three other economic development entities. I would say that the pivot in the strategy really started honing in and focusing during that time. And over the last year, I guess has been a little bit more dialed in, a little bit more focused on small business and entrepreneurship services, on talent and workforce attraction.
Did you have, you guys have a big board. How many members are on your board?
Well over 100.
Did you have to pull the board along in these efforts, or did the board drive a lot of the decision-making here?
We've not had to pull the board along with our newer focus on more inclusive economic growth. And we didn't have to pull them along during the last 18 months where we had to make some of these critical decisions cited by the award. And I'm so thankful for that. We've got a number of bankers and heads of financial institutions on our board that spent a lot of time in the know-how of where we really needed to focus and in focusing on businesses that maybe weren't going to be eligible or high priority for things like PPP. And so we're so grateful. And I don't know how you feel. I have felt like it's really been on us and our ability to focus and execute. It really hasn't been board or anybody holding us back.
Yeah, I would say the board has been very supportive, and I would even, Michael's not going to give himself credit, but I would say kudos to our leadership for having a vision and really the thought process to say, like, hey, you know, small businesses, you know, at the onset of the pandemic, small business is going to be important. Hey, we're going to set up a response hub to be as resourceful as we can and give facts for these different business owners to be able to go to a one-stop shop. But also having the wherewithal to say these businesses also are going to need access to capital. So some of the visionary work that our leadership team here at the chamber, with the direction of our board, was very helpful on the onset. So I feel like they've been nothing but supportive.
I want to get into some of the detail, in particular about the Inclusive Economic Development Incentive Program. Both programs obviously really important, but this one, I remember when the chamber started talking about inclusive growth. I remember when at IBJ, we started writing about the Harvard University research that showed that less than 5% of people who grow up poor here end up in the top 20% income bracket. Basically, the economic mobility here is really tough. I know that was a big driver for the things you did. So can you explain what are the key components to the changes in the economic incentive package? What is now required of a company that wants to earn some incentives?
A lot of it on the back end, and most companies wouldn't notice because we just really looked at the way we score different projects. So, you know, prioritizing targeted opportunity industries that we want to focus on, prioritizing locations of where companies want to locate, giving XBE businesses more opportunities to be able to qualify for different incentives was a big component to it. But also setting some baseline requirements. So, you know, all jobs that we look at that we are looking to incentivize have to provide healthcare for all their employees. All projects have to have a positive ROI for the city of Indianapolis for us to move forward. But I would say the biggest, most impactful component of that was that all award recipients, incentive recipients, are required to dedicate 5% of their total award to a workforce contribution account, which is directly tied to eliminate barriers to employment, which we have identified as training, childcare, and transit.
I think the most controversial point of this was the realization and our belief as an organization, which includes a consensus of the board, that Indianapolis, the city and the region, has oftentimes been not selective enough with these economic development incentives, tax abatements, and things of that nature, similar tools. So there were some people in industry who got upset with the suggestion that, hey, we're not going to subsidize $13 an hour jobs anymore. And you can earn points with the things Vincent was talking about, childcare, transportation, and other benefits. And we were able to bring those into the tax incentive and economic development incentive conversation. It seems pretty simple, but it did draw some opposition. We heard from companies who said, well, because we started with the city of Indianapolis, shout out to Mayor Joe Hogsett and Council President Bob Bosley. The intent is definitely to influence the suburbs. And as we sit here, there are a few suburban communities who are making tweaks and considering similar changes now. But the point is the realization that, I don't know, maybe we haven't been as selective enough, and how can we still use incentives where necessary, but to kind of drive the types of behaviors that are going to create opportunities for people who need them. It was easy in concept, but stirred up some controversy in the implementation.
As I recall, the thing that got the most attention was the focus on $18 an hour. But it sounds like the real impact, and of course that's important, but it sounds like the real impact is in some of these other things that companies are required to do. Why is that the case?
Yeah, I think initially $18 an hour did get the most press, and I think some entities or even people felt like we were trying to push a minimum wage, and that just wasn't the case. We still incentivize companies that may have jobs below that threshold, but for the sake of the way we look at and score projects, we only count a job if it pays at least $18 an hour. But again, I really believe that the most impactful portion of our inclusive incentive is that workforce contribution account. It requires, companies to be a little bit more thoughtful, provide benefits to their workforce, which I think is even more important now post pandemic than it was when we implemented January 1st of last year. There's a lot of creative, collaborations that have fostered from that. We have companies that are partnering with community development, centers, across Indianapolis, whether it's a Mary Riggs who partnered with Ingredion, which is a company on the south side of town to, help uplift and add capacity to their STEM program. Or it's companies like Greenleaf Foods, who located on the east side of Indianapolis, which are doing childcare vouchers for their corporate-wide, also a training program, and also implemented in sidewalk infrastructure improvements for transit. So you have companies that can do one or the other or all three, and it's really more a benefit to their workforce. So, overall, just last year, about $14 million of abatements went through this program, which is going to pretty much create over $700,000 of a workforce contribution fund.
I think some of the pushback around the $18 an hour also came from the fact that we put a number out there. I think it's really important to do in this sense, but it's also the recognition that $18 an hour, an $18 an hour job, a $40 an hour job is not the same from industry to industry. There are some industries who will bring employees in at a lower wage, but they can move very fast. And I can't recommend enough the CICP GPS report, which highlights jobs across the state of Indiana that don't require a 4-year degree, that starts to get into the differences across industries. And yet, I don't want to speak for Vincent, but the city of Indianapolis working with us, we felt it was really important to put a stake in the ground in terms of what that floor would be. The last point that I'll make, Leslie, is it is meaningful that we got recognized by our peer chambers for the award, particularly for this project, because not all chambers of commerce have got the economic development programs within their chamber. But I feel that every chamber of commerce, regardless of the size, can influence the nature of the economic development incentives being awarded in their communities, and literally like making a value statement as to this is how we will use, and this is how we urge public officials to use economic development incentives. You don't have to have economic development programs in-house for this to be a priority for your chamber.
Let's talk about the 5% fund. How does that work? And How is that used?
Pretty much the incentives, of course, are estimated on the front end when we work with companies. So whatever the length of an abatement or an award would be, we pretty much know the value of that on the front end. So with that, we come to an agreement with the company, and the city comes to agreement with the company directly on what that 5% award would be. So we have partners identified to help implement, you know, components of it, whether that is, you know, contributions to Indigo for additional bus stop infrastructures or working with Employ Indy on developing a training grant program. We have expanded that and, you know, looking at, you know, some also like community partners and community centers that are doing great work as well. And, you know, if companies going to locate in the area, then they need to work with a local organization that has grassroots influence in that area. So, you know, that 5% can be expended, you know, over the length of whatever the award is. So if the abatement is 5 years, it can span over 5 years, or it can be put up front. Really, it's really pretty flexible in working with companies on what they feel is reasonable for them and their business model. And so, like I said, from a training component, just, you know, partnering with different organizations or having just in-house trainings that lead to certifications, which is what we want the trainings to be geared towards. You know, partnering with different childcare organizations or providing childcare vouchers is also another opportunity. And in the transit, what we've seen a lot is, you know, adding pedestrian access above and beyond what planning or codes require, or working with, you know, transit partners, like I said, Indigo, and building out additional, you know, bus stop infrastructure or donation to that.
And so I'm curious, do very many companies choose to invest in any way in childcare?
So we have had a few invest in childcare. Transit and training is the easiest route. It's really working with us and building out a better menu of options for that childcare component, which we have a few, you know, working with early learning centers or working with United Way on different vouchers. We also need to look at, you know, adding capacity to like in-home daycares, which we really haven't tapped into. There's definitely work to do on the childcare aspect, but we have had some, like I said, Greenleaf Foods, you know, wanted to do a childcare stipend voucher program for their entire, you know, company. And for us, you know, if you're going to make a corporate company-wide decision to add another benefit to us, that's a win.
Do you feel like you lost any companies because they said, you know what, we don't want to do this and we'll go to a community that doesn't require it?
I mean, I'm sure we have. I would say 99% of the time, once they understand why we are doing the why, they jump on board and say, you know, no, this is a community that we want to be a part of.
Is there anything that you've learned along the way that you think you might be tweaking this program to accommodate what you've learned?
One thing is, the more we can get suburban communities bought into similar concepts. Now, I think obviously it's cities are complex and, you know, no two communities are alike, but some companies within a region might use the Indianapolis inclusive incentives policies to leverage adjacent cities or multiple cities in the Indianapolis region off of each other. So we're finding some success in talking about this more and more in suburban communities here in Indianapolis with some level of success to try to talk about shared values and reduce the kind of cross, you know, municipal border stuff that can happen. I mean, you're never going to put an end to all of that, but I've been really encouraged to see more communities buy into this because nobody wants to be seen as cheap. Some of our political elected leaders, only a few that are in the Republican Party, who Vincent said earlier, we were accused of putting in place some kind of a minimum wage requirement, which is not. I have engaged a few people in the argument to say, who have said, well, we don't think you should use incentives in this way. You're disadvantaging the lower wage jobs, things like that. I've said, well, do you agree with the premise that government needs to be very selective about these incentives? We shouldn't just hand them out indiscriminately. And the person in every case has said, well, yes, I agree with that. So it presents an opportunity, I think, across city of Indianapolis and the suburbs to talk about why these tax incentives intended in the first place.
So let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we will talk about the Indy Chamber's response to the pandemic.
The right data and technology solution can transform your business. KSM Consulting is now Resultant and still passionate about solving problems no one else can. Still collaborating with our clients to find the best answer, not the easy answer. Visit Resultant.com to see what's possible for your organization.
All right, we're back with Vincent Ash and Michael Huber from Indy Chamber talking about the recent award that Indy Chamber won for programs that are really not typically Chamber of Commerce type programs. And one of those that I want to make sure we talk about is the pandemic response. So, Michael, tell us about what you were thinking at the beginning of the COVID pandemic and how you all jumped into action to do something.
So we're very fortunate that we've got a board who's very supportive. They allow us to try different things. They allow us to make changes oftentimes on the fly, because in March 2020, I know every person I know has a story about what they experienced in March 2020. So we're not that unique, obviously. But I think the first realizations of the virus hitting the Midwest and hitting Indianapolis was the cancellation of NCAA basketball, cancellation of other conventions, because obviously we're all proud that we're a top convention city. And then hospitality businesses, restaurants, retail businesses, many of whom were in a panic, not knowing what was going to happen. So we placed a bet, Leslie, and sometimes you swing and miss, and sometimes it really pays off. We placed a bet. We called all of our employees into the big conference room. It was a Friday afternoon. And we said, okay, we don't know what's going to happen now that the virus is here and it looks like these closures are coming. But what we do know is on Monday, we're all going to be working remotely. And on Monday, almost all of us are going to be doing a different job. And that's going to be on small business services, because it looks like the biggest vulnerability that's coming is going to be with our small business ecosystem. And we're just going to set up a hotline to help small businesses. We're going to see if we can lend them some money. Within that weekend, we put up something called the Rapid Response Hub, which was a one-stop shop, because as you know, the information, just the public health information, was changing. Sometimes it felt like hour to hour. We'd take questions from businesses. We had businesses calling in every day. And then over the next several weeks, we kind of went on a journey to raise money, make loans, make grants, and we raised this money from different sources. And Vincent and his team really engineered all this. I still have no idea how they did it. And fast forward to the end of 2020, we had loaned or granted $21.5 million in small grants and loans. And we're incredibly proud of that work. And I'll say, if at any point we had said, well, we need a strategic plan for this, or, well, you know, we can't really do this until we've raised the budget for it, or how are we going to pay for this long term? We didn't do any of that. It was really just really move into action where we knew the need was. And we're just so fortunate that we had our board of directors and our leadership basically saying, go, don't ask questions, just get out there and meet the need.
Vincent, how did you all come up with the program?
Oh man, that was, last year was a time for a lot of people. I would say, you know, our established relationship that we have with City County Council, established relationship that we have with the City of Indianapolis, really, you know, pay dividends for us to be able to add capital to even administer some of these programs. And I would say our staff that we have at the Chamber, very talented, very passionate group of people that really just want to make an impact. There was a lot of long nights. There was a lot of late hours. I think what a lot of people don't know is that we shifted capacity. You know, we have about 55 employees that we pretty much shifted full capacity over to kind of help out. Really, after about a month through April, it got back to May, our day-to-day job started picking back up. So we're doing our day-to-day functions that we have to do that's in our job descriptions, but also adding, you know, capacity, you know, and the free time we do have to administer some of these grants. And
Leslie, I know what Vincent and the team did. I still don't know exactly how they did it, because just the numbers behind it, in 2019, we did under $1 million total in very small loans. Now, we have a heavy focus on services, so it's not just about just like the way a bank would measure itself, but under $1 million in 2019 to go to then in 2020 over $21.5 million. It blows my mind. Now, it helps, like Vincent said, that we reassigned, I don't know, 30 employees and said, you're going to be doing small business services, small business lending for the time being. But the partnerships, City of Indianapolis, Mayor Joe Hogsett, Council President Vop Oseley is a huge one. The Dean White Foundation granted us $1 million. I just got a phone call from the Dean White Foundation that said, and so it's just like the partners and the allies who showed up to help. It would take an entire podcast episode just for us to name off all those names. We were lucky. We were incredibly grateful. And then to have it acknowledged by our peer chambers around the country, it's a nice affirmation.
I'm curious, did you find that companies needed money the most? Did they need advice? Did they need just resources? And I'm assuming that changed over time.
Yeah, I would say initially that advice and resource was pretty critical on the onset. You know, am I, a priority business? And can I be able to continue to work, through? Do I have to shut down? Where a lot of questions that a lot of business owners have. But we also, a lot of small business owners, we realize pretty much only has, 27 days of cash on hand, and they really need the cash to be solvent during the time. We knew things were going to span past that 27 days. So I think it was definitely a priority for both. And I would think it started shifting as, companies and people got more comfortable kind of navigating different restrictions that, money and, access to capital became even more important.
The only other thing I would add to that is we knew that when we were providing capital, this is for the most part money to get people through several months. We weren't kidding ourselves that it was growth capital and things like that. But because the kind of hours that we worked, especially Vincent and his team on just the intake process and making everything user-friendly, it was a lot of late nights, a lot of weekends, like everybody we know. I mean, there was a lot of like pumping each other up and kind of giving each other a lot of moral support. A lot of that moral support though was, and this is daily, it's like, we got to give people hope. You know what I mean? $15,000 loan from us could be the difference between the restaurant staying open and closing forever. So just keep it going. You know what I mean? Make that last phone call. Don't leave anything on the field. Even though we weren't kidding ourselves that this was, capital helping people double their revenues and things like that. This is just helping them survive. It still was gratifying.
Yeah, I would even also say, to Michael's point, like there was a lot of conversations that we had with our like intake and processing team. Like I said, we had a very high touch system before and we wanted to continue that. As passionate as our staff are, we wanted to help every single business that reached out to us. And it just at times wasn't, all the way feasible. There was like, hey, guys, there's probably going to be some companies that are not going to make it out. And we knew that, but again, just wanting to help out as many companies as we can. Like, there's a lot of us that put in long hours just on one company specifically. One thing that we joke about is like we see different sophistication levels throughout different business owners or different business types. And I mean, from a profit and loss statement on a post-it note, which we joke about, but we really did see that, but also coaching them, say, hey, here's an Excel sheet, this profit and loss statement. You already have your tax returns that has this on your schedules. This is how you need to transfer that, talking them through it. Like again, just keeping that high touch system. And so it was fulfilling that goal. We got a lot of encouragement amongst our colleagues to just continue to move forward.
And as I recall, there was quite a lot of diversity in the people who received loans, gender diversity, racial diversity, but also diversity in types of business. Is that right?
Yeah. So out of the like 21 and a half million, 53% went to XB businesses. So women and minority owned businesses. We initially we've seen a plethora of different business types from personal care services to some professional service companies. Retail was very heavy and some of the hospitality industry as well. And those kind of changed and shifted through time as, some restrictions were lifted.
Tell me where the program is today. Are there still loans available? Are you in the wrapping up stage of how all of this works? What's going on?
Still continue to make loans, not quite at the rate that we were in 2020. So the single biggest issue for us as an organization now, and Vincent, tell me if I don't say this right, is from our board and from our community is basically make sure that this small business ramp up wasn't a one-time thing when you look back in 3 to 5 years. So our entrepreneur services division is going through some intense strategic planning. We have a community development financial institution that's part of the chamber, which is going through a strategic plan as well. And we figured out that we could surge and grow our capacity and just the touches and the amount of money into the entrepreneurial ecosystem to a level that I never dreamed of. So how can we put more support out into the entrepreneurial ecosystem on a regular basis as part of what we do every day? We're going to have some strategic choices to make. probably going to have to go recruit some additional folks from industries like banking and finance, ultimately, to add to the folks that we have.
One thing that I think we definitely wanted to highlight is through the process of last year, you know, I think we made what traditional bank institutions would say are risky loans. Like I said, working with, you know, some business owners, you know, where, you know, the first thing financial institutions are going to do is pull their credit report. And you look at some of the disparities, you know, even with that across, you know, demographics, to look at today and realize, I believe, 97% are repaying and paying on time of the loans that we were able to do last year, to me is kind of a business case as to, you know, working with entrepreneurs during that time. That process, I think, will continue to go forward.
Yeah, it sounds like this could change your organization's, change your strategy again.
I think we're changed forever as a result of going through this. Honestly, Leslie, I mean, we were very proud that we have this entrepreneur services division. We've got programs that the IBJ has reported on and others, but we got to do it on a different scale and make more of a difference. And to bring it back to the award, this is a new-ish direction for most chambers around the country. I don't know of another chamber that has within it a community development financial institution as we do. I think it's a struggle for some chambers because membership is so important. If you don't have membership, you're not a chamber. Committing to the entrepreneurial ecosystem, especially helping to provide more tools for diverse owned businesses, it forces you to put a lot of support out there where you don't care if these businesses are members or not. And that's the big gut check for us. And I think there's no going back now. I think we've made this commitment and it's going to be a part of who we are going forward. The great thing is we're not getting a ton of political pushback. We're not getting a ton of pushback within our own board. They seem to be very bought in. I think it's going to be up to us and really executing.
Well, thank you guys both so much for chatting about all of this and congratulations again.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Michael and Vincent. Before I go, I want to direct you to a few noteworthy stories in this week's IBJ. John Russell has a rundown of which hospital systems in central Indiana are requiring their staffs to be vaccinated to keep their jobs. A number of hospitals have estimated that about 30% of their employees remain unvaccinated, which means thousands of workers are running out of time to meet the deadlines. Also, after the pandemic forced airlines last year to cancel routes and fly less frequently, travelers are returning to the air, and airlines are responding. They've added 20 nonstop routes originating from Indianapolis since the beginning of the year. And Indianapolis International Airport officials tell Mickey Shuey they are working to ensure more are on the way. You can find these stories in the most recent issue of IBJ and at IBJ.com. If you're not a subscriber, no worries. You can buy a subscription for just more than $2 a week. Thanks for tuning in to the IBJ podcast. Mason King will be back next week. Thank you.